Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo, and we have got a subject that I know you're going to be interested in. Why? Because every single person, just about on this planet, except for newborn babies, and even then that may not necessarily be the case, are affected by a three-letter word, tax. Let's use the plural and make it a five-letter word, taxes. My guest today is William J. Federer. William is a fascinating man. He is a historian. He has a tremendous amount of publication that he has put out regarding so many aspects of history. William, welcome to the show.
Donna, great to be with you.
Well, it's absolutely one of the subjects, or one of many subjects relating to various aspects of history that you have very much dedicated yourself to. Give us a little bit of background about yourself, and why is it that history has been something that's become a passion of yours? You've published so many different books regarding history.
Well, Donna, I've published about 16 books on history, most of American history, but there's sort of a cross-section of a lot of Western civilization. And I've been doing this for about 15, 20 years. One of my books has sold over 500,000 copies. It's America's God and Country, Encyclopedia of Quotations. And a couple other books have sold close to 15,000 copies. And one is called Backfired, and it's the subtitle is A Nation Born for Religious Tolerance No Longer Tolerates Religion. You know, it's sort of a gives the history of religious tolerance in America. And then the other is a new book. It's called What Every American Needs to Know About the Quran, A History of Islam in the United States. Real eye-opening when you chronicle the history. You know, Captain John Smith, he's called Captain because he spent 5 years fighting the Muslims over in Hungary back in 1600 before he came over to found Jamestown. But anyway, this book that we're talking about today is titled The Interesting History of Income Tax, and I actually have done interviews on NPR, National Public Radio, and other different groups. My degree's actually in accounting, and so I've got a little more expertise in this. But it's really fascinating, especially when you go back and you look at the beginning of our country and see that, gee, one of the reasons that we rebelled against King George III was over what? Taxes. And some of the speeches that were going around the colony at the time, in 1775, Isaac Backus spoke in the Massachusetts Assembly, and he said, "Is not all America now appealing to heaven against the injustice of being taxed? We are persuaded that an entire freedom from being taxed by civil rulers is not a mere favor for many men in the world, but a right granted us by God, who commands us to stand fast in it. And indeed, one of the reasons listed in the Declaration of Independence for which we rebelled, the Declaration lists that the King of England has blockaded our harbors and incited the natives of the frontiers to attack our settlements." And anyway, one of the things in there, it says, "The history of the present King of Great Britain is one of repeated usurpations. He has given assent to acts of pretended legislation for imposing taxes on us without our consent." And of course, that gave birth to the phrase, "No taxation without representation." But we've been birthed as a country where that's been a part of it, and so it's no surprise that that theme sort of runs throughout our history.
Yes, it is throughout our history. And if you go back into history, even back to Babylonian times, taxes have always been around in one form or another, whether it was taxing with chickens or with the dollar bill or coinage, whatever it might be, or salt like it was in the Roman days. All of these things are throughout history. But in the United States, let's jump back a little bit to Jimmy Carter, which is the person that you start the book off with, and this is The Interesting History of Income Tax. He made the statement in his acceptance speech in 1976 that it's time for a complete overhaul of our tax system. It is a disgrace to the human race. And he said the American family is already overtaxed. And at that time, in 1976, the average family spent about half of every dollar they earned in some kind of a tax, whether it was a federal tax or a state tax. And he said, if they continue as they are, by the time a child, a five-year-old child, and that was in 1976, by the time they're 25, they'll pay about 84 cents of every dollar they'll make in some type of tax or government fee. And that was stated by James C. Watts, Jr. in 1997.
And you look, you know, the Internal Revenue Code originally was just 14 pages back in 1913, and now it's over two volumes, 6 inches thick each, and it takes eight volumes of federal tax regulations to explain them. And they estimate over 300,000 trees every year are chopped down just to print the tax forms, 300,000 trees. Anyway, the question that comes to our mind is, did our founding fathers really want to match up, several million pages of 1040s with, you know, several million pages of W-2s and 5.4 billion man-hours go into filling out all these tax forms, and that's time that's spent not working a job and producing an asset or producing income. That's time off. So not just are you paying taxes, but it's a 5.4 billion man-hour drain on what could be going into the economy. And but anyway, it's interesting when you look back at the history. And in 1777, when we had our Articles of Confederation, that was the government before our Constitution. That government did not grant the federal central government any power to tax. It says that the power of taxing was under the authority and direction of the legislatures of the several states. So the states could, the 13 states, but not the federal, not the central government. And that theme was continued into our U.S. Constitution, 1781. And sure enough, Article 1, Section 8, or Section 9, says that the no capitation or other direct tax shall be laid by the federal government. So, again, there was no income tax by the federal government because it was prohibited by our Constitution. And then, of course, the question is, well, how did the government support itself? And if you want, I can get into that, too.
Yes. Well, let's talk about some of the tariffs, because we're back in the 1700s before we get up to where we are now, even though I've talked to you a little bit about what Jimmy Carter said and, you know, Mr. Watts. But let's talk about how some things started. And you've brought up a very good question. How did they raise money? Let's talk about tariffs that were imposed at that time.
Well, the two sources of income for our federal government were tariff taxes, which is taxes on imports, and excise taxes, which were taxes on specific items like salt, tea, tobacco, carriages. But the problem with the tariff taxes is that the taxes that helped the North hurt the South. The tariff taxes caused imports to be more expensive, and that allowed a cushion for domestic manufacturing of those same goods. Of course, we see that a little bit today. The higher the price of oil, it creates a more of an incentive for the local, drilling of oil in Texas and, you know, Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
But when the price of oil goes down, then it sort of removes our incentive. So back at the time of the country's founding, the idea was to make items brought in from France and Europe more expensive. And that allowed the northern states to create factories and be able to sell their more expensive items. But the problem was the South did not have any factories to protect, and so these tariffs resulted in them having to pay a higher price for the European goods or a higher price for the goods manufactured in the northern states. And that led up to the Civil War. That was one of the animosities that built, and there was even situations where South Carolina refused to collect the tariff on goods brought into their harbor, and the federal government was sending troops down there ordering them to collect the tariff. But that was the main source of income for the country, was these tariff taxes. And what happened was, actually, you know, for a while, it did supply the income for the federal government. And you read some of these addresses, like Thomas Jefferson, in his second annual message, 1802, Jefferson said, "We are able, without a direct tax, without internal taxes, and without borrowing, to make large and effectual payments toward the discharge of our public debt and the emancipation of our posterity from that mortal canker. It is an encouragement, fellow citizens of the highest order, to proceed as we have begun in substituting economy for taxation." And that's a little interesting side note here, that Washington was the first president. Adams was the second president. They were Federalists. They wanted a strong central government so they could have a navy, and they had a lot of excise taxes and tariff taxes. Jefferson didn't really want a strong central government. He liked the state governments to be stronger. So Jefferson cut taxes, and we observed an economic boom. The economy picked up. Lower taxes meant people had more money to spend. They spent it, and it caused the economy to get moving. And so that's what Jefferson said. Let's continue in substituting economy for taxation. So you get the economy moving. The government can skim a smaller percentage off of more money changing hands rather than a larger percentage off of less money.
Well, I think his points were very valid. And when we look at today's world, especially in the United States, when so much of our manufacturing is offshore now, so our economy has taken a tremendous hit, but taxes haven't gone down. Taxes have actually increased. And I know, gee whiz, I think here in the state of Washington, where I'm located, there are something like 74 to 84 taxes that are put upon business and individuals. Most people don't even realize that they're there. They're hidden taxes. There's a penny here, a penny there. Before you know it, you've got all of this money going out for taxation just by the state, as well as taxation by the federal government. So who knows? There may be a situation where people are going to say, well, you know, I think we've got a little bit too much going on here, because putting more money in the consumer's pocket really does make a difference. People will want to save. They also will want to buy. That's very, very important. Talk about President Andrew Jackson. He is an interesting man. He said, "Through the favor of an overruling and indulgent providence, our country is blessed with general prosperity and our citizens exempted from the pressure of taxation." Boy, if he came back today, I think his hair would turn triple white.
Well, exactly. And you know, there are three purposes for taxes. One is to pay for legitimate government expenses like navies and highways.
Mm-hmm.
The second is what's called economic engineering. We touched on that a little bit, where you give tax breaks to what you want to encourage and you tax what you want to discourage. And so we wanted to discourage imports, and so we taxed them, and we wanted to encourage people buying locally, so we gave tax breaks. That goes back to Chief Justice John Marshall, said the power to tax is the power to destroy. So whatever you want to destroy, you tax. That's a way of discouraging that. Anyway, the third purpose of taxation was the what's called social engineering, where the government would simply redistribute wealth. And this was not in the founders' minds at all. As a matter of fact, Andrew Jackson, in his eighth annual message of 1836, he said, "Congress is authorized only to levy taxes, to pay debts, and to provide for the common defense and the general welfare of the United States. There is no such provision as would authorize Congress to collect together the property of the country under the name of revenue for the purpose of dividing it equally or unequally among the states or the people. Indeed, it is not probable that such an idea ever occurred to the states when they adopted the Constitution." So the idea that the federal government would collect money from everybody, then the federal government would decide who gets the money back, that's social engineering. You know, some call it just legalized theft. And actually, that concept originated with none other than Karl Marx. Karl Marx, the founder of communism, he said this: "Each man according to his ability, to each man according to his need." So everybody would work really, really hard, but the government would decide who gets it back. The only problem is that the people that were working hard says, well, gee, I'm not going to work as hard anymore because I'm not benefiting from it. And when you look and see that these three purposes to pay for legitimate government expenses, economic engineering, and then social engineering, you can sort of see what happened. Now, we did have a temporary income tax during the Civil War. Lincoln pushed it through. It was called the Revenue Act, and he raised $750 million to help finance the war. And after the war was over, it was repealed. And so there was no income tax in America after the Civil War. And but what happened after that was the northern state, because there was no South to scream, because they'd just been defeated, the northern states passed all kinds of tariffs. And this created these industrial giants, what they call the robber barons, the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, the J. Paul Gettys, the Pullman Railroad Car Factory. And these guys became immensely wealthy. And Teddy Roosevelt took them on. He was the antitrust guy. John D. Rockefeller became the richest man in the world through his Standard Oil Company. And he did it through underhanded means. In other words, Rockefeller made a deal with the railroads to ship his oil cheaper than his competitors. And then he would sell it cheaper and put his competitors out of business, and then he would have a monopoly, and he would raise the price of oil through the roof and then pay back the railroads. And he did this in city and in state all around the country and became, again, the richest man in the world. Well, a lot of people began to scream when he had the monopoly and he was raising the price through the roof, and that's when Teddy Roosevelt took on these robber barons, and he... Since he could not push through, they tried to have an income tax in 1892, but the Supreme Court declared it unconstitutional. Remember that verse that said, Article 1, Section 9, the government shall lay no direct tax? So that was going to be a peacetime income tax, but the Supreme Court in Pollock versus Farmers Loan and Trust did not allow any more income taxes. But that's why Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican, believe it or not, pushed through the inheritance tax, because only the extreme wealthy had an inheritance worth leaving. And this was actually sort of happening worldwide, that a lot of people were upset at the very, very internationally wealthy. In Russia, this manifested itself as in the Bolshevik Revolution, and they went in there and took over. And so there was a communist movement in America, a lot of the international workers' parties and so forth. And so there was this sentiment that was brewing. Then there was a Republican of William Howard Taft that pushed through the corporate income tax, because only the extreme wealthy had a corporate, owned corporate stock. It was originally a 2% tax. And finally, in 1913, Woodrow Wilson pushed through the income tax, and it was just a 1% tax on the top 1% richest people in the country. It was never intended to tax you and me, just those robber barons, but once it got started, we can see where it went from there.
Yes, and just to go back a little bit to 1894, you have a point of information where the first peacetime income tax was done in 1894, and it placed a 2% tax on all incomes over $4,000. Now, we need to remember that $4,000 was a lot of money to those people at that time. And that's the equivalent of, what, over $80,000 today?
Yes.
So that way it only taxed the top 1%, as you mentioned, and only 85,000 out of 12 million people. Now, that is a population. I mean, our population has just expanded phenomenally since then, obviously. But only 85,000 people out of 12 million had incomes over $4,000 in 1894. So times have changed quite a bit.
Well, you're right. And, there was the Pullman Railroad Car Company in Chicago. They had a factory, and then they owned the apartments where the factory workers lived, and then they owned the grocery stores where the factory workers shopped. And then they paid the workers in company script, not even dollar bills, just coupons. And everything was fine until the price of railroad cars fell. There was a big strike, and then the Pullman Railroad Car Company, it was trying not to go out of business, and so one of the things it had to do was to cut the wages. but it left the rents the same, and it left the grocery stores cost the same, and so people would go to work, get paid less, but they still had to pay the same rent, the same for the groceries, mm-hmm. and they got in debt to their own company. And so that's when the Tennessee Ernie Ford song, you know, I owe my soul to the company store, another day
right.
older and deeper in debt. And so there was this public sentiment that was building, and that's why they tried to push through an income tax. But again, in 1895, actually, was the date of the Pollock versus Farmers Loan and Trust. And Chief Justice Melville Fuller said that the original expectation was that the power of direct taxation would be exercised only in extraordinary exigencies, like a war. And it says that since there was no war, they didn't allow it. And then Justice Stephen Field concurred, the income tax law discriminates based on those that receive an income of $4,000 and those who do not. It goes on to say this is class legislation, and it says basically that whenever a law distinguishes between birth, wealth, or religion, it's class legislation and leads to abuses. So again, no income tax in America in 1895, and it was not until the Woodrow Wilson pushed through the 1% income tax there in 1913 that we have. And it's interesting, two-thirds of the senators were millionaires.
That was what was so amazing to me. Two-thirds of the senators were millionaires, and where they were all against an income tax, they were the ones that voted for it, 77-0.
Right. They saw that they couldn't get around public opinion. It was mounting too much. And so they voted for it, and then they immediately created tax-free foundations, the Carnegie Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, and so they could shelter their incomes so they didn't have to pay taxes anyway. And it goes back to that idea that the rich aren't rich because they're stupid. They're rich because they make good financial decisions. And so they found a way to shelter their tax. And then World War One started, and the public said, well, you know, we did have an income tax temporarily during the Civil War, and so now with this World War One, we'll go ahead and allow ourselves to be taxed again. And so they kept the income tax. And there is quite a bit of research into whether or not the 16th Amendment was properly ratified, because it was pushed through in December when a lot of the delegates weren't even there and so forth. But my feeling is the sentiment at the time was that this was not a tax that was going to tax the whole country. This was just a soak-the-rich tax to go after those robber barons. And the sentiment at the time was that the people did not like those robber barons, and so they would have pushed it through anyway. Only later, it was actually Franklin Roosevelt in World War II who expanded the income tax to include most of the country. And that's, matter of fact, a little bit later, John F. Kennedy talks about that. 1961, John F. Kennedy gave an address, and he said, in meeting the demands of war finance, the individual income tax moved from a selective tax imposed on the wealthy to the means by which the great majority of our citizens participate in paying for well over one half of our total budget receipts. So we can see this correlation between income taxes and war. So in the Civil War, we allowed ourselves to have the income tax that was repealed afterwards. World War One, we allowed ourselves to have an income tax. And then in World War II is when it was expanded to most of the populace. And but several things happened during the World War II time that I think is worth looking into.
Yes, I think so. Also, what happened with FDR when he put the wealth tax into positioning, which, again, the average citizen was involved with paying taxes as well as the wealthy went offshore. They went, just like so many have done today, they figure out ways where they can shelter their cash from being eaten away by inflation and by taxes. And the average individual doesn't have that option. And that's still being exercised today.
Right. It's like you squeeze a sponge and the water goes out. And so when you raise the taxes on the wealthy, they're going to try to move. They're going to try to avoid the taxes. I mean, the same way that the common person sees that milk's on sale at one grocery store for, you know, a dollar less than the other one, he's going to go to the cheaper one. And so these big manufacturers realize, hey, I can save not just a dollar, but I can save millions of dollars by moving my factory overseas. And so This is what John F. Kennedy wrote in 1961. He said, in those countries where income taxes are lower than in the United States, the ability to defer the payment of U.S. tax by retaining income in the subsidiary companies abroad provides a tax advantage for those operating through overseas subsidiaries. And he says, many American investors properly made use of this deferral in the conduct of their foreign business. He goes on another address. He says, I've asked the Secretary of Treasury to report whether the present tax laws may be stimulating an undue amount of flow of American capital to industrial countries abroad through special preferential treatment. And then, of course, John F. Kennedy, a Democrat, advocating lowering the taxes to try to encourage the wealthy to bring their money back to America. And but actually, the whole outsourcing that we're experiencing today with all these factories moving to China or India, it all really started with FDR raising these taxes so high during World War II. So when Woodrow Wilson pushed through the income tax, the wealthy created tax-free foundations to avoid the tax. When FDR raised the income tax is when the wealthy began to move their money overseas, and that began this whole outsourcing mess. And then once they moved their factories overseas, they began to lobby to reduce the tariff taxes so they could bring their goods back into America cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the tariffs were lowered, the factories in America said, oh, gee, now I got more competition from my former neighbor. I'm going to close my factory up, move overseas, and then I'm going to join the team to lobby to reduce tariffs so I can bring my goods back into America cheaper. So if you've ever played that game when you were kids, Red Rover, send Johnny over, and the little kids are holding hands, and then the other kids are trying to run through and break through the hands, and if they can't break through, they have to join the other team. So the factories in America, they're trying to make a go of it, but if they can't make it, they finally give up, join the other team, move their factories overseas, and then they join to lobby to reduce the tariffs even more. And then, of course, GATT and NAFTA were the ultimate reductions in tariff. So now, if you're trying to make a company work in America, you not only have all the inexpensive goods coming in from China, but you have the extra expense in America of complying with the OSHA and the union wages and the EPA and the liability and the lawsuits. And there's so many more expenses that it's almost impossible to really make a serious go of having a internationally competitive manufacturing business in America. So we've actually dangled the carrot in front of, you know, through the tax system, we've dangled the carrot in front of moving in the we're disassembling our industrial base as fast as we can, and in the long term, this may come back to bite us.
Big time. My guest today has been William J. Federer. His wonderful book is The Interesting History of Income Tax. Now, William, what is your website that people can peruse through to find out about your other information as well?
Oh, thanks, Donna. My website is AmericanMinute.com, AmericanMinute.com. I send out a free daily email that anybody can sign up for called the American Minute, something that happened on each date in American history. And another little tidbit is 1951 was the first time a deduction was allowed for giving to a church. So prior to 1951, churches did not have to worry about losing their tax exempt status because there was none. And then also, it was during World War II that paycheck withholding came into being. It was an emergency effort to get money to fight Hitler. Once the war stopped, it didn't. And so there's still withholding from paychecks.
Same with the tax on the telephones. But we could go on and on, but we're out of time. William J. Federer, a man who's done his homework, and if you're as interested in history as I am and you want the facts, go to his website, AmericanMinute.com. That's AmericanMinute.com. William, as always, it's a delight having you as a guest, and you continue all your research. You come up with good things.
Well, Don, it's an honor to be on your program, and look forward to the next time.
Yes, sir. Have a good one now.
All right.
This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. Don't you go away. We've got more good things to share.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5222. 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay only $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 1-800-872-8852. That's 1-800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Gedrose. Buy it today. 1-800-872-8852.
Hello, this is Donna Sebo, and our telephone lines are now open. If you would like to call in and chat with me, I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. Here are the toll-free numbers in the U.S., 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. Canadians, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. We also have a direct line of 530-876-3222. That's 530-876-3222. Well, if you're a single person and you love to travel, but you say, I really don't know that I want to do it. I'm all by myself. I don't think that that's too much fun. I was talking with someone just this last weekend when I was on my business trip to San Francisco, and they were expressing this very same opinion. They said, I don't like traveling by myself. I really don't want to do it. Well, since nearly 20% of Americans are in a single household, why should you stay at home and not go anywhere? We've got some suggestions for you, but we're going to take this call first, and then I have some tips for those of you who are single and maybe a way to even save money when you travel. Donna Sebo here. Welcome to the show. First name or initial, and where are you calling from?
I'm Anna, calling from Tucson.
Tucson. Hi, Anna.
Hi.
I know the sun is shining in Tucson.
It's broiling.
You're being broiled, huh? Not fricasseed, but broiled. Okay. Well, Anna, let's see if we can cool things down a little bit. What I'm looking at right off the bat, first of all, money is going to be stable. There is always in the back of your mind a concern about whether or not you're going to have everything that you need, and you usually come up just fine. But what I am looking at is a shifting of attitude. It's a shifting of attitude where you're going to be paying yourself first. And I think that this is going to be part of a savings program that you are going to put yourself into, because you really want to see a financial positioning of independence in about 7 years. And I like this. I think this is going to work very well for you. And I want to say, if you deal as much as possible with a cash basis, or if you have credit cards and you pay them off as quickly as you possibly can, you're going to be able to reach your goals quite easily. And I also want you to learn a little bit about real estate. Actually, I'd like you to learn as much as possible about real estate, because I'm looking at two very good real estate investments in property that are going to serve you well. I'm not seeing you getting into a complex of 120 apartments or anything like that, but I am looking at one piece of property that will have either a home or a business on it, a business building. It's not real big, but it's like a sort of like a fixer-upper, and you can, as the term is stated, flip it and be able to make a little bit of cash that will enable you to get into a second piece of property that I think will accrue a value, a very healthy value, within less than 5 years. So if you should decide you wanted to sell that piece of property, that would be a good thing for you to do. You'll come up with another good value, and then you can divvy up the, let's say, the ante, half going into an investment portfolio and the other half going in perhaps to another place that you'd like to put money into. For some reason, you will have a magic touch when it comes to real estate. But again, I'm not seeing you doing large scale investments. That's not really where you want to be. You don't want to be burdened with that because you're going to want to do travel and some other things. But money seems to be on your mind more than anything else right at the moment. What is a question you would like to ask me today?
Well, that is so amazing because I did apply for a financial loan, and I'm waiting to hear word back on it, and I wondered if you saw that coming in as a positive.
Well, actually, I think you are going to be approved for a loan. May I ask what the amount is for? Not for, but how much is the amount? Is it like $150,000?
No, they didn't tell me a dollar amount. I'm looking to buy a car for my work. I need it for my work, and so I'm talking with a company that submitted the information, and then they're getting back to me on what I, you know, like a pre-qualification.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of
well,
thing.
When did you apply for that?
Within the last, I think Monday. And you know, we've been in touch. He and I have been in touch with each other. He's had some obstacles on his end, internet stuff going on. And I've been...
Okay, let me stop you right there. What I want you to do, I want you to contact at least 7 different lenders. And the reason I want you to contact 7 different lenders is that if you do that at this time, and this is very practical information, it will not work against you on your credit if you do a whole bunch of inquiries at this time. So what you want to do is go to as many different lenders as you possibly can. I'd go to banks, I'd go to credit unions, I would go to various independent services, but I would do it because I feel if they know you're competing, that you are looking for the best rate, they're going to want your business.
Okay.
So don't be afraid. Don't think you only should go to 1 or 2. Get as many as you possibly can. If you do it within a 2-week period, then you could put in 200 different applications at different places. They do the credit check, and again, it will not go against your credit.
Okay.
So often, if you have, let's say, over a period of 3 months, if you ended up having 200 inquiries, and this is an exaggeration, but then that would be like a negative on your credit. But if you do it with that short window, it will not be.
Okay.
But don't just go with one person, and don't listen to their excuses, because with technology today, you don't want somebody stringing you along. It's either yay or nay.
Yeah. Do you see that being approved?
I'm looking at you being able to get a loan. It all depends on certain points of information, but I'm seeing you being able to get a car. My suggestion would be shop around for actually a used vehicle so that you don't have to spend as much cash. You don't want to put yourself into a leverage of discomfort financially because you're buying a brand new car. Sit down and work out your numbers. Look at what you can do in what you would have to pay out. Let's say if you got a 3-year loan on an automobile. Get the interest rate, whatever it would be. Talk to auto dealerships, by the way. Talk to them. See what they'll do for you.
Okay.
Because if you have a stable income, they'll be happy as a clam to approve you. But also check out your used vehicles. And I'll give you a tip, something that I used a few years back. And that was I went to these auto lots that the rental cars have because they buy the fleets for the rental companies. They buy them by the thousands, and they usually turn them over at a relatively low mileage, and they give a very good warranty.
Okay.
So look at how much money you're going to be putting out. If you go and you buy a brand new car, and let's say you had 3%, 4%, 5%, 6% interest, whatever they're going to offer you, if you do that, then look at how much you're going to be paying out. You may have a $20,000 car. By the time you're finished with 3 years, it may end up costing you $30,000.
Yeah.
So you need to work the numbers, hon.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye now.
Bye-bye. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. Telephone number is 877-876-5227. In the U.S., Canadians 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Before we went to the phone call, I was talking to those of you that might be single. You know, 26% of all households are single. Well, we've got another caller on the line. Before I go to that caller, though, let me just finish this information. For those of you who are single, traveling does not have to be as expensive as you think. Consider cruises, and I'll be giving you more information about that when we come back. Donna Sebo here. Welcome to the show. First name or initial, and where are you calling from?
Oh, yeah. Hi. My name is I'm calling from Concord.
From Concord, California?
Yeah, that's correct.
All right, there. And give me your first name or initial again, please.
It's YU, and then the last name initial is L.
Okay. All right, there. The first thing that I'm looking at with you is a lot of papers. I am looking at fine print on these papers. These documents need to be reviewed. Now, I'm not seeing this as being something that's extremely urgent. But what I am observing is that some detail is missing. So this could have something to do with an insurance policy or something that is related to a particular component in your life, and it needs to be upgraded. It needs to be updated. And so I don't think it's going to be that much of a problem to do that, but I do think it is extremely important for you to pay attention to the details. And it's so easy. Goodness, we get so busy and we have so much paperwork that overwhelms us usually on a daily basis that it's easy to miss keeping this up to date. But it's going to be worth your time doing it. Also, what I am looking at is some traveling for you, and I think you're just going to have a wonderful, wonderful time. You're going to be so good at traveling on a budget. I mean, I am looking at you finding deals for travel that are absolutely outstanding. So I want to say, know that you're going to have a chance to visit not just places locally and in the U.S., but you're going to have the opportunity to go overseas. And I am seeing someone that you know that lives in another country that is going to offer you the hospitality of their home. And, of course, that is going to be a tremendous cost savings for you. And then I'm seeing you being able to buy a ticket. I mean, you just have the Midas touch when it comes to being able to travel inexpensively and actually very nicely and well. So keep it up, because I think you're going to have some wonderful adventures with travel, especially in the next 2 to 3 years. So don't be afraid of the opportunities. You'll be very glad that you do make the choices that enable you to go to different places in the world. Now, there, we're going to be going to a break. Would you be willing to stay on the line? And then when we come back, we'll take your question. Okay.
Yes,
we're going to be talking with a lady in Concord, California. When we come back, we'll be taking a break for just a moment, so don't go away, and we'll have more good things to share with you in addition. Don't forget, if you'd like to chat with me, 877-876-5227 or 888-815-9756. We'll be right back in just a moment.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604 or outside of Pierce County, 800-872-8852.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272. Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Ged Rose. Buy it today. 800-872-8852.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.